Today, I am delighted to welcome Samreen McGregor to the show. She is an executive coach who works globally with senior leaders and teams across in industry sectors. She's described by clients as having a unique ability to create the conditions leaders need to stretch beyond their perceived capabilities, make meaningful contributions, and preserve good health. That's a difficult one at the best of times. We'll get into that, I'm sure. Her interventions lie in a unique cross-section between business performance, behavioural change, and embodied consciousness. She is half Venezuelan. Where's it gone? My screen's doing something crazy for me now, so I can't see the last bit of that. We'll get into that anyway. Half Venezuelan, half Indian, and bilingual in English and Spanish. There we go. And in recent years, her family has been traversing a journey involving pediatric cancer. Her 9-year-old son survived a traumatic treatment of brain injury in this life experience, along with unfolding societal ramifications around COVID pandemic and the volatile social, political, economic backdrop, has deepened her personal mission towards awakening leaders into forms of prevention and healing, and the healing effects from inevitable adversities of life. So Samreen, welcome to the show. And as I said, I'd butcher that intro.
No, you did fabulously. And thank you for sharing it, Nigel. It's great to be here today.
It's great to have you on. Tell us a little bit more background, fill in a little bit. There was a lot of things in there. Where are you? Where are you now? Where have you lived? Where family and all those sort of things? What are you doing now?
I'll start with a bit, just orienting me. I live in the UK now, and I am married to a British man, and we have two lovely kids, amazing kids who've, as you've just introduced, have been through an extraordinary start in their life. But I was born in Venezuela. My father's from India. And I have lived and worked very internationally. I've studied, lived and worked very internationally all throughout my life. And there is a relevance to that because I do see that as one of the opportunities and really, really positive aspects of me and my upbringing. But I also have experienced adversities that stem from not having a very clear identity. So that's my background and or national background. I've lived and worked in the UK really most of my adult life. And as you've mentioned, I do quite a lot of I'm very passionate about it, but fascinating work across industries with lots of different businesses. And I do have a real interest in understanding how businesses work, the flow through businesses, what drives and undermines performance within business. But equally, I have a real affinity for what drives people. And starting with myself, using myself as an instrument, I'm really curious about how behavioral change happens. I have studied, I've experimented with, and I've researched and trained in a number of, we'll probably talk about a few of them today, but a number of different facets to that, you know, from psychology to neuroscience, and more recently, naturopathy and embodied somatic work. And as a result of the unfolding backdrop, as you mentioned as well, I am seeing that the passion that I hold psychologically and behaviorally is now integrating into the body. And I've learned that throughout the last, I would say, 100 years or so, we've become reliant as a species on what we do or what we think. And we analyze things and we rely on a brilliant level of cognition that we have as humans. But I've also started to tap into what our body tells us. And there is deep stored insight that we often don't access because of a bias in thinking. And I know I'm generalizing and I'm simplifying that, but there is quite a lot of new understanding in how that works, and particularly given the backdrop and stress and trauma that we live through. And if just take a look at the headlines any day at the moment, you know, whether it's internationally, whether it's, you know, the economy and the state of the economy in the UK or globally, understanding how to navigate some of this is becoming more and more important.
Yeah, there's a whole raft of things I'm going to get into on that from hearing that. And obviously and as soon as you start talking about kind of behavioral stuff and the sort of it opens up a lot of questions for me, because it was something that as a kid many years ago doing my BTEC National Diploma in Business and Finance, did. They had one section which was on motivation in organizations and a lot of things about Maslow and Hertzberg's hygiene factors, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And that from day one of reading that, I was fascinated by why people do stuff and how to get them to do it, kind of thing. A lot of that since then, of a reading that I've done and different things I've picked up on have made me even more complicated. There's so many different models out there, isn't there, around behaviors and how people behave, whether it be surrounded by idiots, whether it be the DISC profiles, whether it be what's the ones where they have the plant and the others, I can't remember, Belbin, which was around for some time, or Ruth, who I had on my podcast a few years ago, talking about strength-based sort of building teams and things like that. How do you, I'm sure that you'll have been into all of these. How do you square these all out? Because to me, sometimes I sit there going, they're very complimentary, but it's too many of them to kind of use all at once, if you know what I mean. How are you using that? And how do you use it in your executive coaching that you do?
Yeah, what a great question, Nigel. And it's interesting because, there's three different parts to the answer I want to give you. And hopefully this is useful especially for people who are wanting to understand themselves better, wanting to understand their interactions better. And, you know, what are those blind spots? What are those things that perfectly well-meaning people get wrong and why they get them wrong? Why conflicts and why certain dynamics get set in that don't help us get closer to our objectives. And look, profiling instruments, psychometric instruments, I still use them. I still use them very much. I'm quite selective about how I use them, because the point you make around that there being too many is absolutely valid. But there is a richness in those options being available now. The important part to understand here is that they all come from different perspectives and schools of thoughts. And I think, you know, one of the things I highlight in and we'll talk a little bit about the book that I recently published, but is that there's a difference between what Carl Jung would have suggested, that we are born with traits. Yeah. And some of these traits are personality traits that are based on preferences and, you know, how we prefer to do things. Some of them are actually fundamentally based on needs. But these innate qualities of us or characteristics tend to lean on the school of what's called dispositionism. So we're disposed. We are born this way. Whereas there is another school, which it's not necessarily in conflict with or at odds with, but it's just a different way of looking at it. And actually, in my experience, is a complement to is situationism. And that is what the environment around us presents us with. And those factors and conditions then enable us or disable us or undermine us or make things harder or easier. And we need to respond to them. Now, if I'm just taking that one lens, if you take a lot of these profiling instruments, they will sit in one of those two classifications. Yeah. And as humans, I guess we like simplicity, or we strive for clarity of meaning. And And these classifications are helpful because they help us understand and they help us box something in and help us make sense of it. But there is a limitation to classification. And actually, if you take some of the other, some specific, Myers-Briggs type indicator is probably the most commonly used individual metric. Yeah. You talked about Belbin, the others, but, you know, it's probably the most statistically tested and it's been used for the longest. And, you know, there's a limitation because it does tend to put you in a particular box, even though there's a spectrum, but it puts you in a particular box.
Yeah.
And that can, you know, at best, it can help reinforce certain assumptions about who we are. And at worst, it could help, you know, or, you know, give us an excuse to not change. So I think it's great to take some of these things and use them to help us understand and make sense, but also understand that there are limitations. I think that there's another aspect to some of these different instruments, and that aspect is correlation. It's a bit like, you know, when we draw a relationship between things, and you can take different qualities and correlate. So if I tend to be quiet in big groups, I am introverted. And these correlations, again, they are helpful because we can understand various contexts and how we might respond. But equally, we can draw conclusions that are not necessarily, you know, we speculate and they're not necessarily, yeah, you know, definitive. And then the third one, I think, for me, is cause and effect. So, you know, what is actually causing our behaviors and what's consistent about that? What are some of the inconsistencies that we need to question and check? And I think that there are some really, really helpful instruments. And again, I use them selectively, but those instruments are the ones that use all three of those. And they don't just classify, yeah, they don't just correlate. They don't, well, I mean, they will give you some cause and effect, but those are based on the first two. And then the final point I just want to make on this is, you know, for me, I think as my coaching profession has evolved, I've become far more interested in creating a space for people to live with the messy, to live in the gray, to embrace some of the things that are not as clear cut as a classification or a specific correlation between, you know, characteristics. And so I would say I would encourage people to be curious about them, but be aware of some of their limitations.
That's fabulous. It's interesting that correlation, causation, cause and effect, and all that sort of thing. It's that thing which every 90% of news stories that I do hear on the telly, I sit there going and look at it and going, there are causalities being inferred from data. The medical industry keeps a lot of people alive, but a lot of the medical industry sort of statistics there is you do get a lot of things that are, what's the word? It's, they take the data and decide, well, actually, this is likely, more than likely. Now, sometimes that's the only way to do it because it's the only data you've got, but it's more than likely it's going to help, which is going to be caused by this. And therefore, by taking that data, doing that, right, we'll do this, we'll take you to the next step. If it's not there, that isn't it. But it isn't always 100% that direction.
Sorry, I interrupted. I got excited. No. I've never done that, but
on our podcast. You say what you're going to say.
No, I just wanted to build on a point there because it's very dangerous when we draw or speculate and then draw causalities.
Yeah.
And then particularly when you're saying it's in the media, it can, and I know we're definitely going down a rabbit hole here, but it can definitely take us down. And it's very influential. And so the same thing would apply to personality tests with us as humans, as individuals, and also in our interactions with others. Because a lot of these instruments are there to help us see more clearly and understand. But if it's based on speculative causes, we're creating an illusion that might not even be true.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the point is there. You will see that drinking a glass of wine is really good for you. and then tomorrow drinking a glass of wine is the devil's juice, and you're gonna it's the worst thing, because there's been a study, and because that study has looked at, like, it's funny actually. I wrote a little comment on someone put something about ikigai, and I've actually got a piece of paper on the ikigai concepts, which I really liked. I went through some battles a few years ago, and that was a concept that I was reading about. I've been intrigued and kind of read the book and kind of got the idea. I liked the idea of it, and read about the guys in Okinawa, I think it is where a lot of it's coming from. And then I saw a document about, documentary about Blue Zones. These, I think it's called Blue Zones, these zones where they seem to be people who last a lot of time. And what one of the things that they'd noticed as well is that there was a pre-digital era in these areas to be the situation where someone will, a grandparent or a parent would pass, but in order to continue collecting the pension, because if it wasn't someone local who knew them and it was a state, they would collect that pension and continue to collect that pension. So when you look at that, the records of organisations of how long someone's living for was based on how long they're collecting their pension and not necessarily how long they were alive. And so some of these, some of that data there was, again, there's the data. We know what it is. But actually, when you dig down into the real data underneath and start critically analysing it, and that, I'm not sure that it was conclusive on that, because again, it was pre-digital, so having the data to go back to and things like that, wasn't it? But it could be that some of these people who've lived for nearly 100 years were three people, or at least two people who've managed to live that long. So that's another, just that whole thing. And then you're right, it's like that reinforcement that you get from your horoscope when you read your horoscope, and sometimes some of these personality things will be those reinforcements, the confirmation bias and all that sort of thing, that you're looking at it and going, it says I'm as bad for it for anyone, that I'll see that and the disc profiles, and I'll see myself in that certain profile. But I also see that, and you've got to use it as a tool of how you might change your behavior, or how to understand someone else's behavior, rather than to decide, as you say, that's me, so live with it. That's who I am. I can't change. I can't adapt, because you can change. You can adapt. And just that's a choice. It's just harder to, in some cases, if you're, natural tendency is to do one thing or another. That doesn't mean you're stuck with that. So it's about understand. I see these things as about understanding your default, understanding your preferred, not your absolute.
Yeah, I love that.
That makes sense.
And yes, absolutely. And being really open to understanding further, and not getting definitive and stuck on where we might be. I absolutely agree. Yeah.
So when you're working with executives and coaching them, how do you, because you're dealing with really successful people, I guess, at that level. They've got to a level and they've done pretty good as they are. And maybe there are things they can change. How do you have that conversation? How do you get them to, because it's coaching, it's not about you telling, is it? It's about getting them to look at themselves differently. How do you do that?
Yeah.
Unless you've got a magic secret sauce that you don't want to share.
Well, of course I've got a secret sauce, that's for sure. But it's a really important part of the work when it comes to personal development. And when it comes to recognizing something that might need to change, because actually, and first of all, defining success is important, yeah? Because success when they're in their 20s and 30s and are, you know, successfully or effectively climbing in line, and I say climbing because there is definitely an upwards movement, metaphorically, in line with their expectations, their aspirations, what society demands or encourages us to consider as success. I think that's really important to take into account, first of all, because these metrics become the criteria by which we as professionals judge whether we are good, whether we are effective, whether we are proficient. So that's, I think, a really important starting point. And my sense is that with most of the people I've worked with over the years, there have been maybe three different possibilities, more, but three. I'm just trying to sort of make it somewhat concise. One is the sort that is really aware that whatever they're doing is not getting them to where they want to be fast enough. Yeah, it's usually a matter of I want to accelerate the pace, or I want to go much further. Yeah, so it's something about that. The second is an individual or a certain of individuals that are actually pretty much unaware, but they're being given the feedback either by the organization or by a specific context of colleagues or a boss, that there isn't something that's not working and that they need to change. And if they don't, that there are consequences to that. And then there's a third, which are probably, and this is probably a more spiritual category, which are people who genuinely just have this thirst for learning and changing and developing and evolving. And I would say those are roughly, there's more categories, but I would say that those are roughly the ones. And coming back to your point around, how do you get someone to accept that there is a need for them to change anything in order to enhance if they've been successful? And actually, I would say that particularly of late, of the last, I would say 7 to 10 years, I've become fairly philosophical about that, because, reflecting on my own experience of life, of ambition, I'm a highly ambitious person. And I mean, to the point where it has affected my health, it's affected my relationships. And I can definitely see these sorts of traits in people, whether it's ambition or whether it's, a relentless need to prove ourselves. There's lots of versions. These are deeply rooted characteristics that come from our life story. And actually, some of that even begins before we were born. They come from previous generations and they're carried through. Yeah. And I'm learning through epigenetics, this is definitely something that's being proven more and more. Some of the gene expression actually can transmit and transcend. So the work that I do with people is to help them spend time, create the space to know themselves a bit better, to really come to terms with some of those data points that typically, when we're busy and we're just going through life with the rhythm that pulls us, we don't have time or the space or the awareness to notice.
Yeah, I suppose it's one of those things where you can lead a horse to water with some people, and at a point in time, you've got to be ready to take on board and to make a change. And actually, I suppose it's conversations and over time, and eventually mm-hmm. someone either will or won't take on board those things. I know I've got situations where I've got people working for me who aren't doing themselves any favors in certain behaviors that they've had. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to talk to them about it. And I can tell with some people that they don't see that there's a problem. Everyone else is the problem, not them. And whilst they do it with as much love as possible, until they're willing to recognize that the influence of that behavior on people's perception of them and upon their successes, until they realize that they can change that and they will get better results and they're willing to change it. Even to the situation where I've got people who've, they literally will cut their nose off, spite the face, because it's they want to be right rather than move forward. And in my industry, project delivery, managing stakeholders, negotiating, I find myself apologizing for things that aren't my fault a lot. Yeah. I apologize for someone who said, I could argue it's not my fault, it's something that they've done. Now, if it's not commercial, it's not contractual, it's all that sort of thing, I don't care. But I've got to that point. I don't mind. I prefer to move forward than have a big fight about something that I'm not that fussed about. Yeah, I'll take the little bit, and I think it's. But some people can't do that and won't do that, and I understand why they won't, because when it's right, it's right. And there are some people out there who take advantage of that. They're just irritating and out of principle. They just wind people up, and we shouldn't have to stand up for that. But it's time kind of choosing your battles sometimes, isn't it? I just find it that willingness to learn, that constant learning, is so powerful for us all, because when we realise we're always wrong, or realise that we could always be wrong, we always make sure that what we're doing is the right thing.
Yeah,
it's not a weakness, it's a strength, because if you do that reflection, you realize actually am I doing the best. And the in imposter syndrome that sits out there in a lot of scenarios, and you see a lot of talk about it at the moment, and that is kind of that's the fundamental there of it. It's questioning yourself, but actually, is that something actually it's healthy skepticism. Rather, as long as it's healthy skepticism about your own decisions, rather than debilitating, stopping saying I can't do anything, then that's right. That's what we need, isn't it? Everyone needs that, because we're not always right. Some people, I'm sure, are listening to the same. Well, I am, but there you go.
I don't know. I agree with you. I think that need for questioning and. The ability to step back and you know, see more than one side, see more than our own side, is definitely in high demand. Let's put it that way. Particularly in workplaces, in project environments, I'm very familiar with the negotiation that goes on in project environments. You know, there's always the need to deliver within finite resources and budget and time. So there will always be a need for negotiation. Now, I would say, certainly in my own experience of working in project environments, in any workplace environment, it would probably be consistent, is that there is a layer, a very clear layer, and it's quite a thick layer, I would say, at which we interact with one another. And that layer is very task focused, and we get hired to do a job. Most of us, I would say, show up in that job or in that, you know, performing tasks that we want to do well. And I would also say that most of us want to collaborate to do well at that level, at that sort of superficial level. In my experience, and certainly what I'm learning more and more, is that some of the deeper layers, which are infused with the muscle memory of the fabric of the organization or the industry that you might be working with, infused with politics, infused with what we each bring as individuals, a big, heavy bag filled with rocks made up. Life experience, and some of those are strong, deeply stuck emotions that may have actually been true in a previous time as children or throughout our life, has an impact on how we then interact at that level, at that task level. And I think some of the things that you were saying there, I mean, I recognize so many of them. In fact, I was talking to somebody just yesterday in an organization that I'm working with. I'm doing a management development program. I'm part of a team. And we were specifically talking about the fact that she, you know, she sees the report. She's got two reports only. She sees them as extremely talented. You know, she doesn't understand why she's going to a management program, because actually the two people that report to her are probably more experienced than she is. And she really, really sees them as you know, very, very high potential people. And then I said, you know, so who, what other people do you deal with? And she said, well, I've got a lot of stakeholders. And I said, so, and how would you describe the process of interacting with them? And she goes, well, I've got to make sure that they get things done. And, you know, there are a few things that actually cause the biggest issues, and there are only a few, but they cause a lot of stress, and they cause a lot of delay, and they cause a lot of obstacles. And so we started to have this conversation about, well, what gets in the way. And actually, when it came down to it, it's a lack of real connection between her and some of these stakeholders. She doesn't really know what, you know, what, where they stand on certain things, but actually she doesn't know them. You know, they're just focusing on the task and the negotiation between the tasks. And she said, well, actually what I'm learning is I need to spend a bit more time just understanding them as humans before we force our own needs onto each other in those tasks. And I would say that Nigel, is really what underpins a lot of these unnecessary energy forces that pull us apart rather than pull us together.
I can hear that. It is that situation where I hark back to a project from some time ago where I was running the project and I'd come into it and they'd been having trouble with this project for quite a few years, actually trying to get it done, different ways of doing it. And there was two different organizations that were essentially having a pitched battle. And it just escalated over time to the point where if one said the sky was blue, the other would say it was green. It just got to that, almost that level of, because they weren't able to listen to the others so much. And they didn't care about the others' point of view. They didn't care about their problems. It was them being unreasonable. It was all that kind of thing. And we ended up having quite a big team of people, a 30 people workshop we pulled together about, right, this is this thing. We're breaking it down into pieces. This is how we're going to do it. Right. You from that organization, you from that organization, you from that organization, you're looking at that bit. And we kind of broke them into groups to go and solve the problem and solve the problem together. So they both all had their own context about, well, what happens? So work it out, explain how it's going to happen. What happens? What are the problems? And what it ended up doing, there was still some personality clashes in there, but what it did actually do is break down so that the people within the one organization knew more about what the people in the other organization were doing. Yeah. And them doing this meant this to them, and that's why that was hard for them, and them doing this meant it was hard for them. And they got that conversation going, and those stakeholder conversations that not at that senior management level, this is an operational level in some ways. By doing that, these guys then started clicking and started working and started making allowances from each other. It was partly relationship building of taking them out of the normal environments they were in, but also that exposing them to each other's roles. And like you say, it's about understanding that person. And where one person saying, when you do that at 4:30, that means I'm not home till 7 o'clock and I don't see my kids. When people start to see those kind of impacts, they start to think, oh yeah, hang on a minute. I really need this at 4:30. Ring them up and go, I'm sorry. We really need it. I know it's going to cause you a problem, rather than why aren't you doing it? And it changes that dynamic. And it's so critical for all of us, I think, that we think about, and I'm as guilty as anyone of sitting there going, bloody idiots, why aren't they doing it right? Why aren't they doing what I'm doing? Why are they taking so long? Why are they doing that? And then you have to sit back and go, hang on, let's think why. Okay, I understand why. How can I help? How am I causing the problem, or am I helping? And it's hard to do because we're all under pressure to deliver.
We are. And Nigel, I think the question that you've just raised there is, what role do I play in enhancing the situation? And what, you know, and what, and then what role do the others play? And I think I love your example because it's helping people to do more than one thing, more than just focus on the task that you've got at hand, or the it's actually to sort of step back, look at the bigger picture, and understand, you know, why are we all here together, and what are some of the nuances of what we each bring to this and carry, you know, and you know, whether it's having to leave at a certain time for your children. I mean, having my own, you know, life experience, I know I'm very sensitized to that now. But I, you know, I'll be the first to admit that when I was in my 20s, because I had a real stream of workaholism, I remember some of the judgments I'd make to about other women. By the way, I'm a mother now, and I'm clearly a mother who's had,
It's all right.
Do you know, that is my best friend calling me from New York, who never calls me, and she's decided to call me. I'm using the laptop because it's got a better camera and sound system, but that computer was still on, so apologies. You can definitely cut that bit out, right?
I hope so. I'll think about it.
Okay. Anyway,
I can either cut it out, or we can give her a name check.
Yeah, you could do. That's true. But where was I? I've really lost my train of thought on that one. Completely lost it.
Yeah, you were talking about the. It distracted me as well. It made me
I've never had that experience. And normally that isn't on, but anyway, apologies. Because the screen is off.
If it's all right for you, I'll put that in my bloopers at the end of the year as well, if that's all right.
Yeah, that's okay.
I do a blooper show where when I'm doing my intro bits, and I'm mangling people's names and things like that. So I kind of keep some of those to one side as well. So I'll use that for that. If I remember to cut it out properly. So we were talking about.
Well, I was making reference to the example you gave about people spending a bit more time before they get. That's right. And now I'm back there. You know, before you get into what are we here to do together? Is it, what do we carry? You know, and actually what I was saying is I'm one who, when I was younger, I would have probably been quite judgmental if, you know, a female peer of mine, and some of them will know this if they ever hear this, you know, had to leave early or wasn't responding quickly enough, you know, and we were part of a team. And now, well, not just now, but, you know, years ago, after I did have my children, I thought, my goodness, you know, my lack of empathy was based on a lack of intuition and experience. And that's the point. And I think we do have different experiences. We do have different expectations based on those experiences. I think one of the most important insights I've gained in the last few years is expectations carry a significant burden for us. If we can loosen our sense of expectations and actually become more curious about, oh, why am I expecting that right now? And what else might be going on for those around me who I'm working with? And then regauge my expectation. Yeah. That often is very helpful in our relationships, our working relationships.
Yeah, I get that. And I think the thing there is that expectations, I know that I've gone through some sort of realizations in the last few years where I kind of had an assumption in my mind of what it needed to move on in the organization that I was in. And that meant I was looking at others and going, well, I've got to be that career monster who is doing 15 hours a day, is doing that kind of thing. I didn't, but you know what I mean? That's the kind of thing that you have that in your mind. I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to get anywhere because I'm not doing that. Mm. And then I kind of went for a bit of a charge to try and get through, take on some extra activities and, you know, extra work to kind of move my career along. And what I didn't do was set boundaries. And I discovered that the boundaries, those assuming you needed to be always on, all that sort of thing. And then after I was off for a while, came back. One of the things I did do, and I've had this conversation with someone that recently said, yeah, I thought you were mad when you came back, Nigel, when you were blocking out your diary and being really belligerent to say, I'm having lunch then. I'm breaking that. I'm doing that there. And going, saying no all the time. And encouraging others to do that and saying, well, that just set your boundaries. Because it was, and what I've discovered is by doing that, people understand where I'm coming from, what I'm going to do. I make sure when I'm doing certain things, I'm meeting what I need to meet, but within my boundaries, because they're my boundaries and no one else's. And then Andy, we had an interview on here. He talks about when I heard on his podcast, and I may have mentioned it before, he was one Friday evening, he was out with his family. They were having a pizza or something or whatever they were doing. Phone rings, picks it up and goes, hello. And it's one of his customers. He says, I'm just sat having some dinner with my family at the moment. Can I call you back? And he said, yeah, so is that all right? And he said, yeah, that's no problem. You shouldn't have answered the phone. And it was kind of, he's right. Mm. my friend Andy was controlling his boundaries. He was in charge. He red buttons there. Not have his work phone. Use it. There's 100 different ways that you could do there. We, by answering the phone to someone else, by answering the EM, or anything like that, we're giving, it's not the person who's contacting us's fault if we allow them to intrude. And that's an uncomfortable place to be, because you feel the expectation, going back to that point, the expectation, that's what you're feeling. The expectation is, I must answer. But the answer to it is, well, he's got an answer phone. Yeah, he'd pick it up. He's left the message, right. He's rung on a Friday night at 7 o'clock at night. Most people reasonably expect you're not going to do anything. Do you know what I mean? Most people expect that you're not going to call them back till Monday. They're just chancing their arm to try and get it. And the ones that aren't, well, either you do or don't deal with them in future.
And actually, what I would say to that, though, Nigel, is that there are people who still do. And I've seen a tremendous change, especially through the pandemic. I think that's created a very different, it's questioned expectations. It's enforced, or it's certainly encouraged people to enforce boundaries. However, the one thing I would say is that there are still people who don't, and there are many, many, many people who haven't had the opportunity yet, and I'm hopeful, to actually question those expectations. But if there's anything that helps us to set and manage those boundaries with real skill, it's questioning our own as well as others' expectations, and questioning it with a sense of openness and empathy, and understanding that actually, whether it's our current situation, coming back to my points from earlier, or whether it's what we were disposed to from messages we may have developed and narratives we may have developed over time, some of that boundary management becomes more challenging. And it is a skill that needs to be developed, and it needs to be honed and practiced.
It's something you've got, and you're going to fail, and you've got to be willing to fail and keep failing and then keep trying again and again and just kind of improve. We're never going to be perfect, are we? Just thinking about a comment you made when I was doing your introduction, and it kind of relates to this, I think, is that, don't want to say baggage, but there's going to be those assumptions and those expectations that you, as a person, that you mentioned, I think, I can't remember the phrase you used, is someone kind of not feeling, having an identity or not feeling a belonging or something like that. And that is something that obviously would influence as well on these sort of things. And how have you seen that personally? How have you seen those kind of things shaping you as an individual, and how have they been positive, negative, and what have you done about them?
Well, thank you. I appreciate the question because as I mentioned to begin with, it's certainly a part of me that's been. I love it. I love the fact that I'm mixed. I didn't when I was a little girl, I'll be honest. I used to think, oh, why can't I be blonde-eyed like all my friends and, come from one country and have, just have one simple way and a clear name that people, can pronounce or, so I could fit in. Yeah. So I could be like everyone else. And I can hear my daughter sometimes, actually, my son is different, but my daughter, she tends to be carrying some of these traits. I now must admit, I really embrace the mixture. I feel extremely fortunate to have just so many different, it enables me to almost sit on the margins and go, okay, I'm not that. I'm not quite this either. I'm not quite sure what I am, but it's given me like a third eye, and it's really lovely. Actually, at times I feel quite privileged, But on the other hand, coming back to not fitting in, there were times when I felt really confused, and this was as a child, this was as a teenager, this was even as a working adult. I've worked in environments where I was very much the minority. I've never looked at it that way. I've never thought, oh, I'm the minority, but I've reflecting back over the years and actually having obviously written this book, I've reflected on that as a part of the adversities that I've learned to navigate. And this very clear tension between wanting to conform and be like others, but wanting to stand out and be myself has definitely been a double-edged sword. And I have found that incredibly confusing as a youngster, and I have found it extremely enriching as an adult because it enables me and it encourages me and it really stimulates me to want to understand people, to want to go deeper in connecting with them, and to accessing a way of feeling and seeing things that are fundamentally different to how I would ever. And that level of compassion that comes from that, I don't know whether it's a combination of, me and who I am and how the skills that I've honed and the kind of work I do, or purely a product of being this mutt that seems to I don't know. But yeah, I really appreciate it, but it hasn't been easy.
Yeah, I think I'm going to tell you off for describing yourself as a mutt. I think that's a terribly negative way of describing that. I think it's, but I can kind of, it's interesting. It's something that I've not, middle-aged white guy, it's difficult for me to empathize. But I love the fact that whole thing of embracing the fact when you were first saying that, I say it's kind of, you want to be boring rather than not when you're younger. That's, I think that's what you kind of get, isn't it? I used to wear glasses when I was a child, and that kind of, that's the closest thing I can think of that I can go there. And it kind of, you were different. You weren't normal is the word. You were just not part of the everyone else sort of thing. Whereas these days, most people are wearing, kids are wearing glasses and there's fashion items, so it's completely different to what it was growing up in the 80s. But I think the that approach to it of being that you've having that mindset of there's so much more you can bring to things now, and that uniqueness of ourselves. And as we get older, we recognize that uniqueness is such a positive thing, and isn't. And everyone else is unique, and therefore that empathy to be able to understand that uniqueness is so powerful, especially in a diverse work organization. You're dealing with the person, not the people, if you know what I mean. And it's kind of treating people individually and meeting people where they are, not just reflecting on your own self. And you mentioned your book there, and we've not. I noticed we're coming up on time pretty soon, and I don't want to have the whole interview and not talk about it. Tell us about the book. Tell us what it's called, why you wrote it, and what are the sort of top things that people might get out of grabbing a copy of your book?
No, oh, thank you for asking that, Joel. So it's, it was, as I know you've written several books, so from one author to another, a lot of energy is, oh no, gosh, I'm really curious about that facial reaction. But
mine was skinny and not a lot of effort, but there you go.
I think a little bit, I'm going to tell you off like you told me off about being a mutt, because it does take time structuring a book and actually making it more concise, I would say, is the hardest part. So I challenge your thinking on that book.
Fair point.
In terms of why I wrote the book, because I had just come out of this journey. And, the acute part of the journey, just a small part about it, because it is really relevant, is that it was very traumatic. In 2017, I was flying. I was loving my career. I had a client list to dream for. I had 2 years of order book, and everything seemed really simple, and life seemed to be going well. And from one day to another, we learned that my son had a brain tumor, and it was a cancerous brain tumor. It took 2 months to fully diagnose it and start chemotherapy, and that was after several surgeries, which then led to radiotherapy. So it was, a 9-year-old boy going through that, being the mother. And to him as well, it's, his younger sister, he was 7 at the time. And it did really derail us as a family. And it certainly, it made me leave my body for a couple of years. And I actually mean that. So 3 or 4 years later, when I had come back, thankfully we were blessed with his survival. And actually, we learned a lot. And, there were some nice things that happened as a result of it all. But, we would never have chosen that path. And then the pandemic hit. And I worked in a large corporate at the time for nearly 2 years, because it was time for me to make a salary rather than run my own business and feel a bit more held and contained. And we had, debts to cover. We had to self-fund part of his treatment in the US. So I finished this job in the corporate and decided I want to go back and do what I was doing, and I'm ready. I was broken in the midst of all that, and it took me a while to piece myself back up again. And actually, writing the book was a bit of a, I need to do this. It's partly catharsis. I've learned a huge amount working in a large corporate during the pandemic, and realizing that actually a lot of people I meet are also carrying traumas. And those traumas tend to be influencing their interactions at work and how they operate in the workplace. And that was where the idea was born. So I wrote it. It evolved into something that I actually really enjoyed doing. And now the purpose of it really is so that I could be even more selective about the kind of client work I do. I have a dream that I want to work with those people that you said earlier, who have that curiosity, who've also are able to live through the discomfort and to do a bit of healing whilst they learn from the process of that healing and how it can impact their effectiveness at work, but also more broadly in their life as a human.
Yeah. Brilliant. And so the name of the book is, where's my piece of paper? I've got it there.
Leader Awakened.
Leader Awakened.
Yes.
Yeah. It's available in all the usual places, I guess.
It is. So and there is
that's brilliant.
Yes, it's available on Amazon, but it's available in most bookshops. And in the US as well as the UK and even other retailers. It also, there's a website called, it's leaderawakened.co.uk, and you've got some information about the book itself, and then it'll guide you to any of those retailers. And yeah, it's cool. Actually, if you're interested in doing some of this work yourself, it's a perfect companion to start you on that journey.
Brilliant. I know that we've got a specific cutoff tonight. So if people want to carry on the conversation, want to get hold of you other than grabbing the book, is that the best place to grab you, or is there another way they can get hold of you?
Yes. Well, on LinkedIn and in Instagram, we've got a Leader Awaken specific area, but also you could contact me directly. And then cool. turmericgroup.com is the website, turmericgroup.com, which is also where you will find leaderawaken.co.uk. Yeah, you could definitely make contact through any of those forums.
Brilliant. Well, Samreen, thank you so much for your time tonight. Good luck with the book and good luck with everything else that you're doing. And have a great evening.
Yeah, and you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Samreen. Bye now.
Bye-bye.